I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Kansas City, Missouri made news earlier this year when it defined affordable housing as something that costs $1,100 a month for an apartment. That rate left people in town scratching their heads and would no doubt strain the budgets of many. Today, we ask why the city has for decades been unable to ensure that residents can find a place to live that fits their budget. Is it the city's responsibility, or should the market determine the going rate? Later, the college football playoffs begin at the end of the month. We'll look at how the picks for those games are made and whether switching to a playoff format has made fans and colleges happier. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Affordable housing is now front and center on the city's agenda. Council members are talking about trust funds and zoning laws and scooter taxes and multi-million dollar solutions as it toils away on a first ever long-range housing plan. This morning, a conversation about affordable housing, what it might look like in Kansas City, and why does the city even need to be involved at all? With us, Councilman Quentin Lucas is back. He's chairman of the council's housing committee. Councilman, always good to have you here.
Good morning, Steve.
Councilwoman Catherine Shields is also here. She's a member of the council's housing committee. Catherine, good morning.
Good morning.
Kirk McClure is a professor in the urban planning program at KU. Kirk, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Let me ask the last question first, Councilwoman Shields. Why does the city need to be involved in affordable housing at all? I mean, why doesn't the private market take care of all this? After all, officials estimate that the city needs thousands of these units. There's clearly demand out there. Why is the city involved?
Well, because frankly, affordable housing, unlike market rate housing, needs to be subsidized or it doesn't occur.
And private developers won't build it.
Not without some kind of aid. And in the past, we've had our low-income tax credits that have been very effective. If it's a refurbishing of an historic building, then there have been historic tax credits. Unfortunately, the availability of those, and even at the state level, support for those concepts has greatly eroded over the last few years. And yeah. So part of what the city needs to do is work with our new governor to hopefully re-strengthen those two existing programs.
Professor McClure, does the federal government do enough when it comes to providing these subsidies that Catherine Shields was just talking about?
Oh, I think the answer there is clearly no. Mm-hmm. We have a very high incidence of households, especially renter households, who pay an excessive burden on their income in terms of housing. And when we get down into the lowest income category, below $20,000, in fact, in Kansas City and across the nation, between 80 and 90% of all of those households have an excessive burden.
Quentin Lucas, how big is the demand out there right now? What do you see across the city?
You know, I think it's significant, Steve, both for those who are at the extremely low income level that Professor McClure was just discussing, but also for folks who might be more middle class or looking to remain in Kansas City proper. If you're looking for good housing opportunities, particularly for single family opportunities, for those who have a number of folks in their family, finding good quality housing stock in Kansas City, Missouri, particularly south of the river, is becoming more challenging. And so we have real demand there.
You know, this issue has been around for a long time, Catherine Shields. So yeah. Why has it emerged now as this big, big issue that it seems to be at City Hall?
Well, I think it's emerged now because it's a problem that's emerging everywhere. It's being discussed whether you're in San Francisco or El Paso or Minneapolis or some little town in Virginia. I mean, affordable housing, it's really coming to the forefront because it is a nationwide problem.
You know, it's remarkable to me the extent to which the focal point in Kansas City has shifted here. We've been so focused on downtown for so many years, and all of a sudden, we're talking East Side, we're talking affordable housing, issues that have traditionally taken a back seat.
I think that's true. And also what's happened, we used to get millions and millions of dollars each year from the federal government that went mainly to deal with affordable housing, either supporting people who are already in their homes so they could afford to maintain those homes, or the building of new homes. But over particularly the last decade, those monies have eroded, and I think every year when we get those dollars, there's less than there was the year before. So this has really shifted from what I think is a federal responsibility onto the local government.
Do you see this shift the same way, Councilman Lucas, this notion that suddenly we're talking about issues we haven't talked about for a long time?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think in some ways local government was fine having the, as we saw it, private market try to address some things before. If you look before the financial crisis, the mortgage crisis, there was a lot of activity, at least, folks into homes, that sort of thing. So at least we thought we were hitting at the edges. And so that allowed local government the luxury, perhaps during the Barnes administration, and our current one, to look at other things like downtown development, those other issues. I think you're seeing a lot more of a quality of life for the average Kansas City in focus, and more people asking us at City Hall, how are you going to make sure that Kansas City is long-term affordable? We're still in a good spot to address it, but the very real concerns around our construction of a bunch of $1,000 a month units and in excess of those with incentivized properties in downtown, the plaza, Crossroads, I think has led a lot of people to say, wait a minute, what is good city policy here and how do we make it more equitable for a lot more folks?
And is there a sense too, Councilman, that the discussion about downtown, that sort of phase of this city's life right now has sort of come and gone?
You know, I think what we're seeing now is people have gotten tired of us saying, let's just have more momentum in Kansas City. We love the momentum, but you need to have inclusive prosperity. And I think that's what people are really looking for now. It's not enough just to say, hey, the wig store has gone downtown and there are a bunch of other cool things. A lot of people realize there's a whole lot of Kansas City there and we can have the coolest downtown in the world. But if we don't have people that can live here, if we don't have families that can live here, we're going to be holding the city back long term.
Professor, to what extent is this conversation unique to Kansas City, or as Catherine Shields pointed out, affordable housing has become an issue in lots of places?
Well, Kansas City is perhaps not unique, but I'm one of those people who's always frustrated by so much of the housing discussion looks at New York and San Francisco. We're not New York. We're not San Francisco. We're Kansas City. We actually have a surplus of housing in Kansas City. We don't really need more. We need to adopt strategies to improve the quality of the housing we have to make better reuse of the older stock we have. I was checking just this morning. We have 18,000 off-market vacant units. These aren't for sale. They're not for rent. They're just empty units sitting out there.
18,000.
That will house a lot of people. We need to find strategies to get those off the market, get them back onto the taxpaying rolls.
No, you're stealing my next question because I can't help but notice that we have all these vacant houses on the east side. That's been an issue we've been kicking around for a while. And here we are talking about the lack of affordable housing. It's out there. Is it, Catherine?
Well, it is, but it's not in a condition where people can use it. And that's why, unfortunately, over the last, frankly, 20 or 30 years, the city's response to vacant housing has been to tear them down. And in fact, like in the Wendell Phillips neighborhood, something like 70% of their housing stock has been torn down. And that leaves, I mean, that exacerbates the problem. Not only, even if you find new dollars, whether federal or whatever, to build new, you're not really going to build something new that is of the same quality of the homes that were built in the 20s and 30s and 40s. And so I have really been an advocate since I'm on the council this time to not tearing down, but rather to finding ways to promote the reuse of existing housing. And we've done a little bit of that. We came up with the Dollar House Program through land trust, where if somebody could show that they had the means to rehab it, they could buy the house for a dollar. But the problem you have is even when you get the house for a dollar, you often find that, let's say it costs you $60,000 to rehab the house, but you can't then, because of the location, you can't then get, nobody can get a loan to buy it from you. And so we definitely need to look at broader programs. One of the whole issues is just issues with title, and we're doing a lot of work on that to try to figure out how to ensure that an individual gets clear title and then can access a bank loan. Maybe you kind of get grandma's house, but the title's not clear on it. So when you want to fix it up, you want to live in it. But when you go to the bank, they won't loan you because you don't really own the house.
Hmm.
And so part of the work that we're doing, like with legal aid, is legal aid is going into neighborhoods and helping the elderly do deeds that allow the property to pass on their death to the relative they want to have that house. And so there's simple little non-money things that we can do too. But ultimately, we're going to have to find a source for funding some comprehensive programs.
You know, how many houses have we sold for a buck, Councilman Lucas? Do you have any idea? Is it 100 or is it 5,000?
Far from 5,000. Yeah. It's been shockingly few, and it's maybe above the single digits, but well below 100 as well. So I think if memory serves me correctly, the 40 category or something of that sort.
At the most,
right.
Yeah.
I mean, it was an interesting program, but as Councilwoman Shields notes, it presented all of the same problems we had. A lot of folks that didn't have the capital necessarily to get involved in the investment. It didn't have that same kind of home rehab for people already in the neighborhood that we were trying to say. And Catherine hits the nail on the head. I mean, for too long, our housing policy has basically been two-part. One, to demolish a lot of houses, and two, to see how much money we get from the federal government this year and kind of pass it out. Not in a strategic way, but just to kind of say, all right, we have some money and we're going to try to do stuff from there. That's the importance of our current conversation now, to say, how do we have a well-defined housing policy that frankly overlays a lot of other city policies, planning, transportation-related policy, economic development, making sure that housing is the core, not just some sort of extraneous issue we talk about after the fact.
You know, it's kind of hard to believe, Councilman, that in the year 2018, we're talking about developing a comprehensive housing policy, meaning we don't have one?
It's exceedingly disappointing. And, you know, I think since I started my council service in 2015, and actually Councilwoman Shields made a fascinating point the other day. I believe her service on council started initially back in 1987.
That's right.
And how we didn't really have a comprehensive policy then, how some 31 years later, we continue to be plagued by that. And so that's why I think it's important that Kansas City has it now, to a point we heard before. There are a lot of American cities that I think are needing to play catch up right now in terms of, we need to really know what we're doing long-term in housing and how we can create better opportunities for our community.
Professor, what do you make of this idea that Kansas City, Missouri, a major metropolitan city in this country, doesn't have a comprehensive housing policy?
Well, as a practical matter, most cities don't, so okay. I don't find it terribly unusual, but virtually all large cities are going through this debate right now. It's a process of right-sizing. We've had so much white flight and capital flight for so many decades before. Pleasantly, central cities are beginning to grow again in population, but we still have to find a mechanism where families moving to central cities are making a good investment. And sadly, Kansas City right now, owner-occupied housing is growing at barely the pace of inflation. Now, sadly, that means that family would be better served investing in a suburban home. So we have to find ways to stabilize and revitalize neighborhoods so those families want to make that investment and are rewarded for that investment.
Are there techniques that maybe Kansas City isn't using right now, Professor, that the city should be thinking about?
I think there's a great many techniques. I wish I could say they're all free. They're not. and therein lies
the
problem.
That's the problem.
Yeah. Everything is about finding resources. But there are communities that are providing low-cost and no-cost loans for rehabilitation. We've already discussed the home for a dollar idea. There are a variety of property tax freezing techniques. There are technical assistance programs to help people rehab. So there's a lot of these. They all take some dollars.
We're talking about affordable housing in Kansas City. Councilman Lucas, as chair of the Housing Committee, are you looking at all those ideas the professor just threw out here?
You know, I think we've vetted a lot of those ideas. We have 12 ordinances sitting in committee right now, some of which go more aggressive in the inclusionary zoning realm, trying to make sure that affordable housing development is part of new subdivisions throughout Kansas City proper, from the mm-hmm. north end to the very far south, to somewhat simpler solutions that are looking to affordability requirements in our incentivized product. I mean, I think what we're really trying to make sure we're doing now is this, doing no further harm. If you look at the Beacon Hill area in Kansas City off of Truce near 27th Street, that's an example of where local government with our federal government allies, right, basically tore out a whole neighborhood. We've built up a new housing stock. Everybody's got these extreme property tax breaks. Mm-hmm. And now we have a market of homes that are selling for $600,000 and more. And while that's interesting, what it does not have is diversity. What it does not have is lots of folks that are, frankly, even middle class or those who are making less. And that's not how we want to do things long term.
It's a continuation of what this city's been about for maybe too long, going back to the 40s and 50s.
Well, that's exactly right. And I mean, there's a lot of talk around gentrification, and I won't get into the full conversation of it, but what I think city government should not do is be the leading driver of it. It's one thing to come up with responses to market trends. It's another thing to distort a market so much that you're actually creating some sort of deleterious effect upon the residents and folks who've lived there for decades. And that's an issue that we have certainly along the Truce Corridor now, and we're seeing it a lot of Kansas City.
So, Professor, the issue then with rehabbing existing housing stock, to go back to that idea, simply is it's really expensive, right, to get any one house back up to speed and attractive enough for people to want to move in there.
Yeah, sadly, that is the case. We have more than enough housing, but it is not in the best shape. Rehab, you would think, well, gee, you're starting out with this existing structure. It should be an enormous savings over new construction.
Right.
And sadly, that does not prove to be the case.
Is there a typical cost associated with bringing one of these houses up to speed?
Well, there are a lot of numbers in a lot of communities, but the notion is this, that you're looking at usually very nearly 80% of the cost of building it new. So it's not a huge savings. But what we are doing is saving our community's investment in infrastructure. We're saving the neighborhood, helping to revitalize it. We have way too many neighborhoods with too few people.
So for a city like Kansas City that's struggling with this idea of tearing them down or building them back up, how should we be thinking about this?
Well, I know there's never a popular thing to say because tearing down is never a good solution, but we do have to right size. We have to keep a good correspondence between the supply of housing and the demand for that housing. And right now, Kansas City still has a surplus of housing, which means we're probably going to be looking at selective demolition for some period of time.
Okay. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's go to a phone call here. Sharon from Kansas City, Missouri. Sharon, we're talking about affordable housing in Kansas City. Good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to just say that Milwaukee, Wisconsin, has used a public-private partnership in developing primarily for the housing authority, but they have put in thousands of new constructed homes at a subsidized price that is affordable for people. And this is something I think this city could really benefit from, because they infilled vacant areas like our local areas are. So many demolitions have occurred, so that you can install 20 houses at a time, and you suddenly have community as opposed to fixing a house. And they did it very close to what it would cost to renovate.
That's interesting, Sharon. Thank you for calling. Professor McClure, what do you know about Milwaukee?
Well, Milwaukee is very much like a Kansas City, so it's a good comparable.
Right.
The reality of it is, I think the best thing that Sharon said is building communities.
Right.
We don't want to be thinking in terms of a unit here, a unit there. We need to really be identifying those neighborhoods that can be brought back at a reasonable number.
So concentrating our focus and our dollars in very finite areas, it sounds like you're saying.
That's correct. There simply are not enough resources to bring back every part of the city. So we need to figure out, it's a triage process, figure out which ones can be brought back and made stable.
Is that possible politically? I mean, for a council where everyone has interest for their districts from north of the river down south. Is it possible to galvanize the council and focus on one or two areas of the city, Catherine?
Actually, I think you can, and particularly if we can come up through the housing committee with a plan that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I for a long time have talked about the idea of almost going block by block. And, you know, we have the program that Diane Cleaver handles that is really trying to put a program together for that, where you identify key blocks and what you need to do to strengthen those blocks. And that may be rehabbing two or three houses. It may be doing an infill of one or two houses. It may be putting in gardens so that people have healthy food to eat that live there. Right. But it's a comprehensive plan. But yes, I think the council has been very supportive of the program she has. And I think the city is supportive. When you look at the passage of the 1/8-cent sales tax for economic development that passed all over this city, even though it's focused on basically the 3rd District and a little part of the 5th District.
Well, as you both well know, there's talk about a property tax increase to directed at affordable housing. How likely is it that we're going to see a vote and maybe even passage of something like that going forward? Councilman Wagner up north has made that proposition.
You know, I think that's an interesting proposal. One of the challenges of it is that it anticipates a vote in November of 2019 as opposed to one perhaps this April or one even in August.
And you have an issue with waiting that long. You want the current council to stand behind the vote
that's correct. Yeah, I don't think we should necessarily punt the issue to something later. So the real conversation is going to be, is it the sort of thing that should be on the April ballot that also has mayor and council elections, also is going to have early childhood, et cetera? I mean, we keep talking about affordable housing. It's about time, instead of saying, let's wait to answer those issues, can we try to address it now and up front and make sure it's impactful?
Okay. Would you expect a vote in April or November, Catherine?
Well, again, I think there's a lot of looking at it before we decide to put it on the ballot either time.
Okay.
You know, we've just increased the property tax for the $800 million bond issue. And so I think it needs a lot of discussion. And I commend Councilman Wagner for putting it out there so we can begin to have that discussion.
Yeah, you do get a sense this city is maybe more so than any time that I've been here, 35 years, this city is more ready and willing to sort of pay money to fix these long-term problems than it's ever been.
I think that's true.
It's an extraordinary time right now.
That's why we need to be sure when we're particularly asking our citizens to give us more of their money that we're asking them to do it for the right programs.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go back to some phone calls here. And Kelly from Kansas City, Missouri. Kelly, you're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, guys. And Kirk and Quentin, at least you knew I couldn't resist calling into this show. But in any event, We're affordable housing developers in Kansas City and developing projects throughout the Midwest. And I commend the city for getting focused on this issue, because not only is it a local, regional issue, urban, suburban, rural issue, it's nationwide. And I think you're going to start to see more talk about it as we're seeing in all of these locations. And again, I have a few disagreements with some of the things that are being said, but Kirk, you taught me well. And certainly some of the housing stock out there, some of the single family housing stock is in need of, you know, a lot of repair. And also, we can't look beyond the economic and demographic trends of more and more people deciding to rent. You know, when our population is going to be made up of baby boomers and Generation Xers,
right,
the single family home is not going to be the typical demand approach anymore. So doing more apartments, micro units, what have you, is really something that we're focused on. And we're out here in the trenches every day, trying to fight the fight to build more of this housing for the city. And again, I appreciate what the council people are doing. Appreciate Kirk's effort in the fight. And we're here to stay. There's a lot of financing. And at the end of the day, there's a demand curve that's long and deep in this market. So we're here to stay from an economic perspective, and willing to be a great partner with the city to make this happen.
Kelly, thanks for the good call. I appreciate it. You know, one of the issues, Councilman Lucas, that you've been talking about is the need for a housing trust fund of one kind or another. You see different figures bouncing around for how much money a fund like that would need. First, explain to us, what would that fund do and how much money do you need?
You know, so first to answer the money question, we're proposing $75 million. We wanted an impactful amount of money that could at least start to really address the problem instead of these smaller kind of piecemeal amounts that we often see.
And what you spend the interest each year on affordable housing, is that basically what
right.
this is?
I mean, the goal is each year, yeah, we're spending it on affordable housing. And the bigger question is, so what does that mean? It does actually mean some of the things that Kirk was talking about before, creating loan opportunities for those who are looking to purchase single-family homes, those who are looking to move from rental to home ownership, making sure that we have more money, not just for minor home repair, but when we're talking about rehab of some of that older housing stock, there are real costs to replacing a roof of an 80-year-old home. There are real costs to actually making it kind of a modern structure that we would want. And so this program is one that has been seen in a lot of other American cities, Charlotte, Denver, et cetera, and we're trying to make sure that we're using that type of effort here.
Is $75 million, Professor, is that enough money for a city the size of Kansas City? I mean, I know you'd want as much as you can get. I get that. But is that a worthy target?
It's a worthy target. The obvious difficulty is it enough? No. The scale of the problem is huge. But is it sufficient to be impactful? And yes, I believe it is.
How do you get $75 million together?
Yeah, it's like blood from a turnip, but the idea is
last time I checked, turnips don't have $75 million.
Right. Yeah. I mean, here's the deal that we need to look at, Steve. One, part of the money will be some of our federal grants and other things, CDBG, the Community Development Block Grant, et cetera. But even more to the point, I think it's time, instead of us saying to the taxpayers to give us more, we need to start fighting for general fund dollars that go here. We're about to have on our docket requests to help fund city payment for different economic development tools, et cetera. The question I have now is, do we care about affordable housing enough to put real money here? And I think it's about time that we say as local government we will before we even go to the taxpayers. I think it's important for us to say we get $5 million out of the general fund. It's real work, but it's really important work.
Okay, we're going to leave our conversation there, and it was a good one. I want to thank two members of the Kansas City City Council, Quentin Lucas, Catherine Shields, Kirk McClure, professor in the Urban Planning Program over at KU. Thank you all for a good conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Yeah, thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk sports and the college football playoff system. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, Clifton Truman Daniel and Lucy Baines Johnson shared stories of being part of a presidential family. You can hear our conversation and other previous episodes. You'll find them at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, East High School students organize a debate for next year's candidates for mayor of Kansas City, Missouri. We'll ask them what they ask the contenders. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. For college football fans, we're starting to get into the most wonderful time of the year. That's the college football playoffs. The three-game tournament was created in 2014 to pick a national champion, and audiences so far have been enthusiastic about the new format. To get an inside look at how the 13-member selection committee actually works, we have with us Steve Weberg. He lives in Liberty, and he's a former sports writer for USA Today. He was the first member of the media on the college football playoff selection committee. Steve, welcome. Nice to have you.
Good to be here, Steve.
Also with us to talk about developments in the Kansas City sports world, that's KCUR sports contributor Greg Eklund. Greg, welcome back.
Hi, Steve.
Well, Steve, you started on the committee when it was created back in 2014. This is the first football season that you aren't on the committee. Do you miss it?
Oh, yeah. By far, it's the coolest thing I've ever done.
Because?
Start with the fact I was able to sit shoulder to shoulder with Condoleezza Rice.
Not bad.
But the coolest part for me was, I mean, not just her, but you know, number of coaches, number of athletic directors, number of college sports officials who I'd gotten to know over the years. But, I mean, you know how this is. There's that little bit of arm's length between the media and the people that they deal with on
Absolutely.
The other side. And I was able to be a colleague. And what was refreshing to me was not just a colleague, but they accepted me. And they accepted my input.
Even a lowly sports writer from USA Today.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they became friends. And I mean, I one of my best friends from that committee is Jeff Long, who is the AD at Kansas now and was the first chair of the committee at as the AD at the University of Arkansas.
Yeah, I'm just struck, Steve, that the makeup of these college football playoff committees is so different than the NCAA basketball committees. How so?
Well, the basketball committee, which is longstanding, is just college basketball administrators, college administrators. There are conference commissioners, there are athletic directors, and football playoff. And I actually think this is the beauty of the football playoff committee is the diversity of perspective. So you have the administrative point of view. You also have they have 4 to 5 former coaches on the committee. You have that point of view. This is the first time they've ever put a media person on that committee. And I like to think that you know, the media person can bring some real value to it in the way that we can see the big picture and the way we've, you know, spent a lifetime evaluating teams across the country,
right,
not just within our conferences. And then also bringing in, people like Condoleezza Rice, who I think they brought her in probably for some star power. But the fact is, you know, from the beginning, she was the smartest person in the room, as you might expect.
It was obvious.
But she also was football smart. You know, her dad was a longtime football coach, and he had kind of brought her into that world.
Right.
They actually sat down and talked strategy together, and it became very apparent very soon that, yes, she did know her football.
Greg Eklund, what do you make of the fact that folks like Condoleezza Rice are on the College Football Playoff Committee?
I liked the way they varied from the norm in creating this committee, and not just those football coaches and administrators that are involved today, but they had also Tom Osborne, the former Nebraska head coach, on the committee.
Mm-hmm.
So even those who are removed from the game but were involved, obviously, from a very close perspective with the game and stay connected to the game. I like the way that the football committee formed itself.
Having been on the inside, I mean, I can just tell you the value of those different perspectives. And I've said this a lot of times. I mean, believe me, the viewpoint of those coaches in the room is very much valued. They carry a lot of weight. But you wouldn't want 13 football coaches in that single perspective, just like you wouldn't want 13 administrators. You certainly wouldn't want 13 former sports reporters. But having all of those perspectives together, there was a real value in that.
So all those different perspectives are great, but you're aiming for what? What's the goal?
4 best teams, period.
Period. Okay. And different people have different thoughts on what those 4 best teams are.
Absolutely. And you know, I might come at it from a more analytics type of a perspective, strength of schedule, that type of thing, whereas the coaches in the room might come at it, you know, more from what they see. And I've told Tom Osborne this before. I can watch the same thing you're watching, but I'm not seeing the same thing that you're seeing because you've been a coach.
Right.
But I think
the players and the athleticism and everything else.
Absolutely. And seeing the strengths and weaknesses of a team and seeing, you know, what might, you know, in those areas, what might divide certain teams, because the line of differentiation can be very, very thin, as we've found from year to year, and as obviously it was this year.
What kind of restrictions were you under as a member of the committee when it came to talking to the media and that kind of thing, Steve?
I mean, obviously, those are a lot of my friends. The only restrictions were...
A little awkward at times?
No, it really wasn't. And I worried a little bit about that. I worried that I would be getting phone calls from buddies saying, okay, let me know what's going on here.
Yeah.
Give me a hint, who's going to be in that Final Four. Nobody ever did. I was grateful then, and I'll always remain grateful that nobody tested me on that.
Didn't take advantage of the relationship.
Absolutely. And I would have stood firm. I when I came on the committee, and I also let people know up front, I'm going to play by the rules here. If you don't ever want another member of the media to be a part of this committee,
right,
just let the first leak come from the media member of the committee.
Absolutely.
And they respected that. But our only restriction really, and that wasn't just for me, it was for everybody, was they didn't want all 13 members of the committee speaking out about what was going on, maybe in 13 different ways. They really wanted things restricted to the chairman of the committee and to Bill Hancock, who's the executive director of the college football playoff, basically to just have a unity of message.
The college football playoff system is our topic. Greg Eklund, expansion of the tournament comes up every year. There's four playoff teams now, but you say conference commissioners are becoming more vocal about it this year. What did you mean by that?
Well, one in particular, Mike Oresko, who is the commissioner of the American Athletic Conference, has been more vocal in recent weeks because that happens to be the conference where Central Florida is one of the members. And Central Florida, for two straight seasons, has gone through the regular season undefeated. Their coach, Scott Frost, is up at Nebraska now, but his successor, Josh Heupel, who was a former assistant at Missouri, kept the thing going. They had another undefeated season this year. So they're on the outside looking in, and there's a lot of money at stake here to get into the college football playoff and for any conference to be left out. The Big 12 is fortunate this year. It has Oklahoma, but Bob Bowlesby may not have been as vocal, but I guarantee you he would not have been happy had Oklahoma been left out of the college football
playoff. So,
Greg,
if you were to expand the number of teams beyond four, what would the number likely be?
Likely eight, I would think, if there's any consideration for that at all. I don't see under the present leadership that there is any leanings toward expansion, but it continues to be a debate annually.
But why wouldn't there be a lean towards expansion? Because it would ultimately mean more money, wouldn't it, Steve?
Maybe.
More games, more money.
But the money's pretty good right now. A big, big thing is preserving the regular season and not having the playoff be so big and so all-consuming that it dwarfs the regular season. Understand first that college football's regular season, or college football in general, is really the backbone of financially of athletic departments around the country. It's what pays for, you know, the non-revenue sports. It pays for the tennis programs, the golf programs, the gymnastics programs.
Right.
Those, you know, 6 to 7 home games a year where you're drawing 50 to 60 to over 100,000 people, that's very, very important to these conferences and to these schools. And now think about the NCAA basketball tournament. It is so big. It's wonderful. March Madness.
Right.
But what about the regular season? You know, Kansas can, you know, play Michigan State in November and there's modest interest, but it's not life or death.
Right.
College football has that life or death aspect to it from day one of the regular season, and they want to preserve that. They don't want
some of the big schools, if they lose a game, they're probably out of the playoff system where they could be.
Absolutely right, and you certainly can't lose more than two games, right. You know, which has been the track record to this point. So it is about preserving the regular season, not making the playoff so big that people don't care as much about the regular season, and also preserving a bowl system that is an integral part of college football as well, provides opportunities not just for the few teams that are going to get into the playoff, but for, you know, 80 teams,
right,
that are going to get a postseason opportunity.
So, gentlemen, the four teams in the playoffs this year are which four schools?
Oklahoma,
Notre Dame,
Clemson, and Alabama.
You know, I'm wondering, you're based in the area, Steve, so I'm curious about your perspective here. If teams in the Midwest, say, or the Northwest, or wherever, are constantly left out of these big tournaments, do audiences wind up tuning out? Are the college football playoffs evolving into a more provincial event? It's always going to be the Deep South, for instance?
Well, things run in cycles. The SEC obviously has been the dominant conference here for the past few years, but that has kind of come and gone. You can ask that question about the West Coast right now, and that's where a lot of eyes are because the Pacific 12 Conference has not been as strong. They've missed the playoff the past 2 years. They've missed it three of the past 4 years. College football really, since television became more predominant, went from a regional sport to a national sport. It has a national following. The one way I could see there maybe being a little bit of drift is if we have the same teams, not necessarily from the same areas, but the same teams. Alabama's been in it every year now. Clemson has been in it 4 years. If we have another Alabama Clemson championship game, will people ultimately get a little weary of that?
Well, Greg, you put that question to Bill Hancock, the executive director of the college football playoff system. Let's hear what he had to say about the danger of regionalization here.
What we have in postseason football is the bowl experience. So if a team doesn't become one of the four, then certainly it has a chance to go to a bowl game. And the bowl experience for student athletes is still a significant part of their overall experience in playing college football. And the bowls are doing fine. They're healthy and strong. TV viewership is good. Strong, actually. Attendance at the bowl games has declined over the last 3 years. Is that because of the CFP? It's too soon to say.
That could be a factor, though.
It could be down the road, especially since Bill mentioned that attendance is down in some of the bowl games.
Yeah.
But there are so many of them, Steve. There's bound to be some that are going to suffer from that.
We just have a few minutes left. Let's tick through some local sports headlines here. Greg Eklund Park wins the NAIA National Championship in volleyball.
Women's volleyball, yes. Mike Tolomantes has done a tremendous job there. He's the coach of the men and the women at Park University, and they finished the season with a 36-1 record.
Wow. Washburn is seeded fifth in the NCAA National Volleyball Tournament.
They were seeded fifth and made it all the way to the national semifinals. So Washburn, which had a lot of players from the Kansas City area on its team, got very far as well.
Greg, you say there are some KC connections to teams at the D1 NCAA tournament.
Of course, Stanford is one of the four teams in the Final Four in Minneapolis this weekend with the St. James High School connections, Audriana Fitzmorris and Jenna Gray. Hmm. And, of course, Nebraska won it here in Kansas City a year ago, and the Huskers are back in the Final Four. They're the defending champions.
Benedictine College is playing in the NAIA National Football Championship Saturday in Daytona Beach, Florida. That sounds nice, against Morningside College from Sioux City, Iowa.
And Benedictine has never won a football championship. The last basketball championship, there have been two national championships in athletic history at Benedictine, both in men's basketball, more than 50 years ago.
Wow. Mizzou's going to the Liberty Bowl. Should we be excited?
Well, Mizzou fans are, and Barry Odom got an extension out of it, so
okay.
It's looking up for Mizzou.
With the playoff format, what's the significance of these bowl games like the one Mizzou's going to?
Well, it's all along, I think the Bill Hancock's message is that this should be a reward to the players for having a good season, and a reward for the fans who want to travel somewhere for the holidays to, in most cases, but maybe not in Memphis's case, to a warm weather climate.
Are they going to win?
Against Oklahoma State? Should be a good game. I don't know if they'll win or not, but should be a good game.
That's KCUR sports contributor Greg Eklund. Greg, always appreciate it. Steve Weberg, former sports writer for USA Today, first member of the media on the College Football Playoff Selection Committee. Thank you for your time.
Thanks
appreciate
for having
it.
Me.